President Trump is pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement for the second time.
The exit may go faster, maybe more painful, or have more impact with a spillover effect this time around.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, the Paris Agreement without the U.S. Also, what to expect for Russia and Ukraine from an administration setting peace as a priority.
The war must end. Every single person has said the war must end.
And there's a way of talking that's become trendy in South Korea.
You can probably hear raising tone at the end, even though it's not a question.
Why that uptalk is illegal in North Korea.
Plus, in a church in Spain, bacteria have been enlisted to save priceless frescoes.
Those stories and much more coming up today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us this Wednesday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that if Russia and Ukraine come to a peace deal, a minimum of 200,000 European troops would be required to enforce it. Those were his comments at the Davos conference in Switzerland this week.
President Trump says ending wars is a top priority for his new administration, but how that will happen has not come into focus. The World's Daniel Offman starts us off today with a look at what Trump's cabinet nominees are saying about the war in Ukraine.
Just hours after the inauguration, President Trump was in the Oval Office signing executive orders and taking questions from reporters. On a few occasions, he was asked about the war in Ukraine and his thoughts about Russian President Vladimir Putin.
He can't be thrilled. He's not doing so well. I mean, he's grinding it out, but most people thought that war would have been over in about 1 week, and now you're into 3 years, right? So he can't be thrilled. It's not making him look very good.
Trump then expressed his interest in making a deal. He said Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was on board, but he wasn't so sure about where Putin stands.
I think he's destroying Russia by not making a deal.
Alina Polyakova is the president and CEO of the Center for European Policy Analysis. She's been tracking what Trump's key appointments have said about the war in Ukraine.
There really has been one key talking point that we've heard, and that is that the war must end. Every single person has said the war must end.
What Vladimir Putin has done is unacceptable. There's no doubt about it. But this war has to end. And I think it should be the official policy of the United States that we want to see it end.
President Trump is clear this war has to stop. Everyone, I think, should be on board with that.
This is a war that needs to end, and I think he can do it in the near term. I really do have a lot of confidence in his ability to actually get to a position where this war is actually over.
That's Secretary of State Marco Rubio, National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, and Trump's Special Envoy for Ukraine and Russia, Keith Kellogg. In an interview earlier this month on Fox, Kellogg said that his goal is to enter negotiations to end the war within the next 100 days. However, Polyakova says that despite the interest in ending the war, the pathway to get there is uncertain.
Right now, there is no deal to be had with Mr. Putin. He signaled no interest in it. We haven't compelled the Russians to the negotiating table in good faith. And at the end of the day, that's not a scenario I think Mr. Trump wants. I don't think he wants to meet with Mr. Putin and get a bad deal out of it.
Yesterday, President Trump said that it's likely that the U.S. would impose additional sanctions on Russia if Putin doesn't come to the negotiating table. Polyakova says that so far, Russia hasn't budged from its maximalist demands of Ukrainian demilitarization, a commitment to never join NATO, and regime change, all conditions that are non-starters for Ukraine. But Polyakova says there are ways that the U.S. and Ukraine can compel Russia to come to the negotiating table.
Something the Trump administration has done and Trump won was a maximum pressure campaign on Iran, which really hurt Iran's oil revenues and weakened the regime quite significantly. And this is a strategy that could effectively work against Russia.
Polyakova talks about using the $300 billion of frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine, completely cutting off Russian oil and gas exports to Europe, and increasing secondary sanctions against countries that are still going about business as usual with Russia.
We need more leverage to force the Russians to the negotiating table. But that really starts with providing more weapons to Ukraine to be able to inflict more casualties on the Russian side to make this war even more unsustainable for the Russians.
Some of Trump's appointed officials have said that Ukraine has to do more to slow down Russia's advances on the battlefield. In an interview with ABC, Mike Waltz said that Ukraine needs to lower its draft age to 18 in order to address manpower issues.
We need to see those manpower shortages addressed. This isn't just about munitions, ammunition, or writing more checks. It's about seeing the front lines stabilized so that we can enter into some type of deal.
While the Trump administration hasn't committed to providing new military support for Ukraine, Secretary of State Rubio was clear that without slowing down Russian advances, it will be very hard for Ukraine to walk away with a good deal.
Putin's goal now is to have maximum leverage so that he can basically impose neutrality on Ukraine, retrofit, and come back and do this again in 4 or 5 years. And that's not an outcome I think any of us would favor.
To prevent that from happening, Rubio said any future deal will require solid security guarantees for Ukraine. And that, Rubio says, will require concessions from every party engaged in those conversations. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
In Colombia, violence between two rebel groups is displacing thousands of residents. More than 80 people have died in the fighting in recent days between the National Liberation Army, or ELN, and a breakaway faction of the former FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Colombia's government has declared a state of emergency and has started deploying 5,000 soldiers. Reporter Manuel Rueda is following this story from Bogota. I asked him what was behind the surge of violence between the two groups.
Well, to put it briefly, it would be drug trafficking. These are rebel groups that have long sustained themselves with profits from the drug trade. And this region that they're fighting over is actually one of the areas in Colombia that produces the most coca leaf, which of course is the base ingredient for cocaine. There was an uneasy truce in the Catatumbo region between the FARC, EMC, and the ELN for several years. For reasons that we don't quite understand, it has broken, and the war basically started last week when the ELN went house to house, dragging people out of their homes and killing civilians whom they accused of being collaborators of the FARC EMC group.
Wow, dramatic. Remind us who the ELN and the FARC are.
So the ELN stands for National Liberation Army. They're a rebel group that has been around since the 1960s, inspired by the Cuban Revolution. They have around 6,000 troops, not just in Colombia, but also in Venezuela. The FARC EMC is a group that originates from the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which was the big rebel group that made peace with Colombia's government in 2016. What happened is that there were like some people who did not subscribe to the peace deal and then formed, you know, this remnant kind of group that they call FARC EMC, in which they have been recruiting new young people that were never even involved, you know, in the war that ended between the FARC and the government of Colombia almost a decade ago.
How many Colombians have been displaced in this region in this fighting so far?
So far, there are 30,000 displaced people, according to Colombia's Human Rights Ombudswoman. And these people are leaving from a region that has around 300,000 inhabitants overall. So it's a pretty dramatic rate of displacement. 1 out of 10 people from that region have apparently left.
Wow. Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, is trying to establish peace between these two groups. Where are those efforts amid all of this?
So during his presidential campaign 2 years ago, Petro said that if he came into office, he would sign a peace deal with the ELN within 3 months. That has not happened. The government has really struggled to convince this group to lay down their weapons. And, you know, part of it is because the leaders of the ELN have a big motive to stay in the war, because they are benefiting from the profits of the drug trade, from running gold mines in remote places. Last week, he actually suspended the peace talks with the rebels. And this week, they issued arrest warrants that had been suspended with rebel leaders that were in the peace talks. So it seems the government is taking now a more militaristic approach, which is something that many Colombians actually welcome.
Manuel, you've mentioned that lots and lots of people are fleeing this area. Can you tell me anything else about what life is like there for the people who have stayed, what they're living through right now?
Basically, those towns in this area where the violence is happening, the Catatumbo region, now look like ghost towns. people very rarely go out. People only go out for a short time during the day, maybe to buy some food, and then lock themselves up at home. Like, the main urban centers within this region are now being heavily patrolled by the military, but fights are still breaking out in the rural areas. So it's still a very risky area, and that's why many people are leaving.
Manuel Rueda is a reporter based in Bogota.
There is a culture war going on in North Korea, and one form of it is a crackdown on bourgeois fashion. Sunglasses, frilly wedding dresses, unauthorized hairstyles. Even more concerning, though, to the regime than how people dress is how they speak. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports on North Korea's attempt to root out what Pyongyang calls the language of puppets.
Subservient and nauseating. That's how South Koreans talk, according to North Korea's government.
It's a disgusting way of speaking Korean language. That's what they are saying.
Sahi Kang is a linguist with Middlebury College in Vermont and an expert on the North Korean dialect. The regime is now heavily enforcing a language protection law that prohibits talking with a South Korean intonation. It's actually a crime to speak with a lilt. Professor Kang says South Koreans do speak in a rising, falling lilt.
Even in greetings, 안녕하세요, 안녕하세요, you can probably hear raising tone at the end, even though it's not a question.
울산의 미세먼지 농도는 어제에 이어 오늘도 보통 단계를
That's a weather presenter on South Korean TV. The North Korean law calls such intonation coquettish. So how are Koreans supposed to talk?
미국의 극악무도한 대조선 적대시 정책이 근절되지 않는
That's a North Korean anchor exalting a hydrogen bomb. She is certainly not coquettish. North and South Korean are not two different languages, but they have evolved in different directions since Korea split in two about 80 years ago. Sung Kyung Kim, with the University of North Korean Studies in Seoul, says Pyongyang is more paranoid than ever about the influence of K-pop and South Korean soap operas.
South Korean popular culture is really spreading to North Korea, that's for sure.
More than 80% of North Korean defectors interviewed by South Korea's government say they had secretly watched South Korean dramas back home. Sung Kyung Kim says in her interviews with North Koreans, they say smuggling a video file is getting easier now that more North Koreans have laptops and smartphones.
People tend to watch them alone or with very few people, such as family members or very close friends.
The penalty is minimum 6 years of hard labor. Pyongyang officials call South Korean speech the puppet language, since they believe the United States is the puppet master of South Korea. The law says it's a place where people speak a jumbled together language that is lowly and garbage. Linguist Sahi Kang says this refers to South Koreans borrowing from English. Shampoo, fashion, wife. These are words South Koreans use all the time.
Nowadays, younger men are all calling their wives wife in Korean. But we don't have F sound, so they call their wives waifu, waifu.
That would be a crime in North Korea. Its government is fixated on proper socialist titles. North Korea says it will break the spirits of those contaminated by puppet culture through mass struggle meetings and even public executions. But Sung Kyung Kim says 41-year-old leader Kim Jong-un is trying out another tactic, too.
From the moment that Kim Jong-un came to power, he made a significant effort to get the support from the ordinary North Korean.
She's talking about the Moranbong Band, North Korea's own all-female pop group. Instead of coquettish love songs, they perform tunes called Advancing Socialism and Let's Study. And their skirts are short, but not too short. It's the regime's way of fighting K-pop with their own style, NK-pop. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The first Chinese settlers arrived on the islands of Taiwan 400 years ago. Indigenous populations have lived there much longer, and still others may have scattered across the Pacific. New archaeological evidence is emerging about one of those groups, and it matches indigenous stories. For this story, reporter Ashish Valentine takes us to the mountains of northern Taiwan, where the Saisiat people live.
I'm only a 3 hours drive from the bustle of Taipei, but it feels like another world. The air's cool and misty, but thick with smoke from ritual fires and the fermented tang of homemade millet wine. Dozens of people lock arms as they dance in a giant circle. But they're not alone. The Saisiat believe we're surrounded by spirits known as the Kokota'ai, a people their ancestors shared this place with a very long time ago.
They are really short, and they have dark skin, like really dark skin, and some people say they have magic.
That's Awai Maya Titiong. Her mother's Saisiat and her dad's from New Zealand. She's been coming to the ceremony every 2 years since she was a kid. It's called the Pasta'ai. Now she's old enough to start helping out. That includes helping outsiders like me not offend the Kokota'ai.
Everyone will have to be careful and cannot have bad mood and cannot fight with each other and cannot throw stones at an empty place because they might hit the spirits.
For several days, the Saisiat welcome the spirits of the Kokota'ai into their village. They dance from evening till morning, offer millet wine and food, and sing songs that contain the knowledge the Kokota'ai gave to their ancestors.
The 16th song includes all the traditional plants that we have. And so Kokota'ai, they come and then they teach our people how to grow the millet and then also how to weave.
But tradition says the Kokota'ai also have a mischievous side. A Saisiat volunteer wraps silvergrass around my arm, protection from harmful spirits. I keep silvergrass tied around my sound recorder the whole weekend. Apparently, the Kokota'ai have wiped memory cards before. Until recently, most of what we knew about the Da'ai came from stories. Atao Apong is an elder and a former school principal.
Long time ago,
a long time ago, he says, our ancestors lived on this mountain. One day, they started hearing strange noises, possibly music. Some of the Saisiat people realized they were songs coming from a neighboring group of people, the Da'ai. We realized we can learn a lot from each other, he says. They taught us skills like weaving and how to plant crops. Unfortunately, the good times didn't last forever. So the story goes, some of the Saisiat women started getting unwanted attention from the Da'ai. One day, when the Da'ai came to our village, he says, some of us made a large cut in the bottom part of the tree the Da'ai used as a bridge to cross the river back to their home. When the Da'ai tried to cross the tree bridge to go back home, it collapsed. They fell to their deaths in the river. After this, life got tough for the Saisiat. Rains would either be extra heavy or not come at all. Babies were dying. Crops failed. Eventually, two of the surviving elders of the Da'ai appeared at the Saisiat village, he says. They told the Saisiat the only way to stop what's happening was to hold a ceremony to remember the Da'ai spirits every 2 years. It's hard to say how long ago this happened, but since then, without fail, the Saisiat have honored their promise. Many indigenous groups in Taiwan have stories about similar peoples. In the Philippines, right next door to Taiwan, there are ethnic groups that slightly match descriptions of the Da'ai, like the Ayeta people of Luzon. Researchers sometimes call these groups Negritos, a term that comes from Spanish colonization. But for the longest time in Taiwan, there wasn't any physical proof Negrito peoples lived here, just stories. That changed thanks to a team led by Taiwanese archaeologist Hung Xiaochun at Australian National University. As an undergrad at National Taiwan University over 2 decades ago, Hung remembers seeing a 6,000-year-old human skeleton at the Anthropology Museum.
Oh,
I saw it was very small and broken, she says. It was placed alone in a display cabinet. Every time I saw it, I always had this indescribable, special feeling. 3 years ago, Hong finally went back with the team and compared these bones with a huge database of known human populations. The closest living match to the bones, she says, are the Negrito peoples in the Philippines. It was the first physical evidence that Taiwan was once home to a group similar to the Negrito peoples. Hong says, based on the evidence available, these people arrived in Taiwan at least 7,000 years ago, and they could have been around as recently as the 17 or the 1800s. For Hong, it's case closed. These Negrito peoples were the basis for the Da'ai story. But she's not the only researcher involved, and not everyone's so confident.
I think it's important to point out that I'm not in any way stating that there were a sizable population of Negrito people in Taiwan, and they are the origins of the Coco Da'ai story.
That's Toby Openshaw, a filmmaker and researcher who's been working with indigenous communities in Taiwan for over a decade.
For me, it was really just before we had no evidence of anything in that direction, now we have something.
Openshaw co-edited a book called Seeking the Coco Ta'ai. It pulls together Hong's findings alongside all the latest research into who the people in these stories could have been. We actually went to this year's Pas Da'ai together. On the drive back to Taipei, I asked Openshaw about why it's so hard to prove the stories one way or the other. The answer's got a lot to do with Taiwan's hot, humid climate.
So bone material tends to decay very, very quickly here. And that's why we only have a few places where we have archaeological finds that are over 5,000 years old.
But Openshaw says, regardless of the evidence, stories like these show Taiwan's indigenous peoples already know they weren't the first people to arrive on the island.
In Taiwan, the indigenous people recognize that they were not the first humans in Taiwan. That's accepted and recognized. So they do not say, we were here first. They just say, we were here before you.
By you, of course, he means the Han Chinese, who make up over 90% of Taiwan's population. The elder, Atao Abong, also isn't interested in proving the story one way or another. We don't really want to dig deep into it, he says, because at the end of the day, we know the story. If we take a scientific approach, trying to prove things one way or another, what if our people start dying? As far as we're concerned, if there's no Pas Da'ai, there will be no Saisiat people. On the last day of the apology ritual, dozens of Saisiat elders gather at the river where they believe the Da'ai drowned so long ago. An elder thanks the Da'ai for visiting and promises to see them again in 2 years. For The World, I'm Ashish Valentine, the village of Ufeng, Taiwan.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a rebel group has seized the city of Minova. Now refugees who'd settled there are on the move again, and those living along the escape route fear starvation.
We don't farm and we live off the lake. But with the capture of Minova, access to Lake Kivu will be limited, and that makes us very worried.
That story and more global news ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For years, the growth of Israeli settlements in the West Bank has been very controversial and has angered Palestinians. In recent days, there's been a fresh wave of violence in the occupied West Bank, with Israeli settlers attacking Palestinian villages. This recent cycle of violence started when gunmen attacked Israeli settlers in the Palestinian village of Al-Funduk. Who controls the West Bank is the driving question here. We asked Hugh Lovett with the European Council on Foreign Relations to explain how fighting in the West Bank has been worsening.
So we have an Israeli settler population that has long sought to persecute Palestinians and displace them, attack them. You have a settler population that was itself attacked in Al-Funduk. And then you have this anger with regards to the ceasefire in Gaza. And so this very much has now blown up in the West Bank. And so we've seen almost every night Israeli settler attacks against Palestinian villages, especially Palestinians in this town of Funduk, as a part revenge against that community. And also, making a clear statement to the Israeli government and everyone else about that the settlers are very much here and are determined to continue to annex and settle Palestinian land.
So for people who have not followed this closely over the years, how would you describe the relationship between Israel and the West Bank and why it is so contentious?
So when it comes to the relationship between Israel and the West Bank, it is an ideological relationship. So many in Israel will see the West Bank in a framework through a biblical lens. So they will refer to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria and talk about Jewish claims to what they see as the Jewish homeland. There is also a military lens through which Israel sees the West Bank. Israel has been occupying the West Bank since 1967. And again, this is all also about politics and the role of the growing and increasingly powerful Israeli settler movement within Israeli politics, within the Israeli government, in a way that is increasingly dictating Israeli policies.
What does international law say about the status of the West Bank?
Well, international law is very clear. The West Bank is Palestinian territory. It is occupied. And Israel is building settlements illegally. And international law also, according to the International Court of Justice, which recently ruled on Israel's presence in the West Bank, the International Court of Justice said Israel's presence is illegal and Israel must bring to an end its occupation as soon as possible. Of course, Israel refutes and rejects that ruling. Israel will firstly claim its biblical right to the territory. It will also argue very incorrectly that the Oslo Accords trump international law and give them the right to remain there.
As Israeli settlements in the West Bank have expanded, Hugh, how have Palestinians living there been affected?
Palestinian communities in the West Bank have been heavily affected by Israeli settlements, firstly in terms of being displaced, evicted from their lands and their homes, but also in terms of security. So people often talk about the security issues facing Israeli settlers. Less talked about are the security issues faced by Palestinian communities because of those settlers. And we have over the past years seen increasing settler violence, increasing settler radicalization, and increasing insecurity for Palestinian communities in proximity to these settler communities.
Yeah, I was in the West Bank last April, and it was stunning to see how brazen the settlers are rolling in an ATV right through the front yard of a Palestinian home. And the family told me settlers had earlier blown up a gas canister in their courtyard. And I'm wondering, is that typical, or do you see that more as an effect of October 7th and the attack on Israel?
I think it's important when we talk about Israeli settlers that we also understand the relationship between the settlers and the state of Israel. Often, I would say most of the time, actually, when Israeli settlers attack Palestinians, they are doing so with the protection and acquiescence of Israeli security forces who will stand by, who will not intervene when these settlers are attacking Palestinians. As soon as Palestinians push back or fight back, and such as throwing stones, then the Israeli military forces who are present will then intervene and attack the Palestinians alongside the settlers. But this symbiotic relationship between the state of Israel and the settlers, I think, extends in a way that's much broader than that. So it's about the sense of impunity that this has given to the Israeli settlers. They are infrequently arrested and even less frequently prosecuted. But the Israeli state is also sponsoring the Israeli settler movement, supporting it politically and financially and economically. So yes, Israeli settlers is a problem, but it is only one aspect. It is also of Israeli policy. It's very much an embodiment of Israeli policy.
So we've seen this uptick in violence. If this is an inflection point, how would you describe it?
So I'm not sure I would say this is an inflection point, but rather it's a milestone in terms of the continued deterioration of the West Bank's security and political scene. In my view, because the factors on the ground are so longstanding, they will continue to drive this deterioration. And when speaking to U.S. officials, say, there's long been kind of a question mark about when will we see this big explosion in the West Bank? And the explosion never quite seems to come, despite these moments of, you know, a very localized violence. I think the better way to look at it is that the West Bank is slowly deteriorating. Every day is a little bit worse than the other day. It can make it more difficult to capture in terms of the totality of the systemic collapse that we're seeing. It may take longer to play out. It may be less visible, but I think the ultimate end of this trajectory will be the same, which is likely a complete collapse on the Palestinian side in terms of the collapse of the Palestinian Authority, explosions of violence, and something that becomes even more serious than it is today.
Hugh Lovett is a senior fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He joined us from London.
Today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged governments to keep their promises on climate change mitigation and chided financial institutions and corporations for backtracking.
I want to say loudly and clearly that this is short-sighted. And paradoxically, it is selfish, but also self-defeating. You are on the wrong side of history. You are on the wrong side of science. And you are on the wrong side of consumers who are looking for more sustainability, not less.
He delivered those remarks at the Davos World Economic Forum after President Trump signed an executive order to pull the U.S. out of the UN Paris Climate Pact. Johan Rockström joined us from the Davos Forum. He's director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, and he gave us his prediction for what happens with the Paris Agreement going forward.
So, of course, there's a risk that this spills over, and it may, first and foremost, of course, spill over to countries like Argentina, the populist governments we see in some of the European countries, the Saudi Arabia, countries that may take the opportunity and see this as a legitimizer for, at best, pausing action on climate, at worst, starting to revive old climate denialism. So that is a real concern. The second reason why I'm so particularly concerned is that it's 2025. We're halfway through the decisive decade where science shows clearly that the global emission of greenhouse gases need to be cut by half. And we're still increasing emissions.
I've heard the concerns you outlined voiced a lot before, this idea that if this big, rich country is not doing as much as it could on climate change, other countries will say, well, we don't have to either. But is there a way to tell if those concerns are well-founded? For example, did ambition slide after the Trump administration pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement last time around?
If you look back at history, in Trump 1, the Paris Agreement did not collapse. Countries did step up, and even states in the U.S. stepped up to fill the gap from the void created from the White House. What worries me is that with the first Trump administration, Europe was in a stronger position on climate policy. Today, Europe is in a weaker position because of the position of countries like Hungary. We have a trend also in Europe of populist governments in both the Scandinavian countries, but also in Austria. And remember that we soon have elections in Germany. We have a weakened governance in France. This does potentially make it slightly more challenging this time around, but I hope I'm wrong.
I recall that in the first Trump administration, there was an announcement of withdrawing from the Paris Pact right away, but it actually didn't go into effect. The U.S. did not officially withdraw until the very end of Trump's term. So I'm wondering what the timeline will be this time around and if that is likely to make the impacts perhaps bigger of that U.S. pullout.
Potentially, yes. But again, the jury's out there. Will countries, particularly the big emerging economies like India and China, the Southeast Asian economies, but also Brazil. Remember that the next climate negotiations are led by Brazil, a very constructive and committed government under President Lula. So we may be surprised by countries stepping up in their climate leadership, but still, the exit may go faster, may be more painful or have more impact with a spillover effect this time around. What really matters is, do we or don't we have really senior, experienced climate diplomats from the U.S. in the room or not?
Mm. I know that the U.S. and specifically the U.S. cooperation with China has been seen as key to moving this process forward in the past.
Absolutely. You know, China, U.S., Europe, together with India, are the four nodes that, put it simple, will determine whether or not we succeed in avoiding climate disaster and unmanageable climate futures.
I want to talk about money. Part of the deal of the Paris Agreement is that richer countries will help poorer countries tackle climate change. Just this past fall, there was a new target agreed to. Developed countries said they would triple their amount of climate funding to $100 billion a year by 2035. What happens to that target if the U.S. isn't putting money into that pot for the next 4 years?
No, I think there's a big risk here that also the finance does not come forward. And if finance does not come forward, we know the implications. Then the developing countries dig their heels in and refuse to have any discussions on phasing out coal, oil, and gas. The European Union here, I think, are really trying to do their best to bridge this impasse by saying, look here, we are willing to step up with more climate finance, actually to go beyond the 200, 300, potentially even 400 billion US dollars, but that will have to be associated with what is called conditionality on developing countries also committing to bend their curves to deliver on reduction of coal, oil, and gas emissions. So we're up for very significant debate, climate debate in this area. You know, today there's a lot at stake.
Johan Rockström is director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research.
In Valencia, along Spain's Mediterranean coast, a feast of sorts is underway. The guests, bacteria. The main course, glue. And it's all in the name of saving art. So the glue in question was, until now, obscuring priceless frescoes in an iconic Baroque-era church. The Royal's Jerry Haddon met up with a team that's training microorganisms to devour the stubborn, sticky stuff.
There's a long story that gets us to the glue. The St. John's Church was built in the 13th century. In the 17th, a painter added the frescoes, religious scenes painted on still wet cement. All was good, parishioners were happy, until the fire in 1936, says art restorer Pilar Roche.
Pues esos son los fragmentos que quedaron después del incendio. Imagínate. Pues esto igual en toda la bóveda.
Take a look at this photo of the damage, Roche says, showing me a large black and white printout. We're inside the church on a busy day. Workers are moving scaffolding around. Roche points to a bunch of white patches in the photo. Those are all the sections burned away by the fire, she says. Just imagine what was lost. There were once some 12,000 square feet of frescoes overhead. More than half were lost in the blaze. Roche's job is to somehow make things as they were before. Luckily, she says, there was a photo from before the fire, a silver gelatin print made in the 1920s. She says that old image has been her guide.
Esta fotografía es la que nos ha salvado la vida. Claro, hemos hecho tratamiento digital.
Without the photo, all this would be lost, she says. We perfected the image, digitizing it, adding the correct colors based on the palette of the fresco's painter, Antonio Palomino. With photo in hand, Roche and her team then mapped the ceiling inch by inch. Today, they're making exact life-size digital versions of the missing sections, printing them on carbon fiber panels cut to size, which they then fasten to the church ceiling, like fitting new pieces into an old puzzle. From the floor below, the finished sections look perfect. But to make them look perfect, Roche and her team have also had to restore the parts of the frescoes only partially damaged by the blaze. Roche leads me up a series of scaffolding staircases to show me. Here, 90 feet above the floor, you could reach out and touch the church's main dome ceiling. And you can see that what remains of the original frescoes here isn't exactly original.
No se les ocurre nada más que arrancar.
In the 1950s, Roche explains, some art restorers had the grand idea to just peel the damaged frescoes off the ceiling in order to save them. They used what was called the strap technique, she says. You slathered on a layer of glue, then pressed a strap of cloth against it. When it dried, she says, you tore the whole thing off. Think of it like how body hair remover works, says Pilar Bosch, a scientist also working on the project. You apply those sticky sheets of wax to your skin, she says, and when you tear them off, the hair goes with them. The 1950s restorers then glued the removed frescoes to giant plywood panels, cleaned them, then nailed them back into place. But they must have done the cleaning very quickly, Bosch says, haphazardly and with few resources. They didn't get all the glue off. And that's where the bacteria come in. Bosch is a microbiologist who happens to be Pilar Roche's daughter.
la vida y luego también el haber mamado siempre el arte, la restauración en mi casa.
I grew up absolutely immersed in the world of art restoration, she says. My father was also involved in it. It was a part of my life and education.
Mi tesis de doctoral.
My thesis and postdoc research were on how to get the glue off of these frescoes, she says, and we found an effective, sustainable way. Meet Pseudomonas stutzeri, an everyday bacteria that Bosch has isolated and trained to eat glue and nothing but glue.
Porque es metabólicamente muy flexible y muy adaptable.
She says this bacteria is flexible and adapts quickly to food sources. It now produces all the enzymes it needs to metabolize the glue. I call it probiotics for art, she says. Like the good bacteria people take when they're sick, mine cures frescoes. Here's how it works. The bacteria is mixed with a viscous marine algae to keep it moist. Then it's smeared onto the fresco where it needs just 3 hours to break down the glue. In Bosch's lab at Valencia's Polytechnical University, technician Sara Robles removes the jelly-like layer from one glue-stained fresco panel.
Se observa que en las zonas donde hay acumulaciones de cola, pues sí que se ve reducida. Entonces también.
You can see that where the glue had accumulated, there's less now. Robles says, inspecting the bacteria's work. Now, with the help of these brushes, she says, we can remove the rest of it. And with that, she continues softly sweeping the loosened glue away.
El problema que tenemos en la universidad muchas veces es que las investigaciones se quedan en un documento.
Lots of academic research gets locked away, says Bosch, who's watching. It's nice to see this research being used to better the world in some way. If all goes to plan, Bosch, her mother, Pilar Roche, and the bacteria will wrap up their work on the frescoes next year, and the church will fully reopen to the public. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Valencia, Spain.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a powerful rebel group is marching toward the provincial capital of Goma. That has sent thousands of refugees fleeing. The militia, with ties to neighboring Rwanda, has already seized control of an important trading hub. The World's Sarah Birnbaum brings us this report.
Thousands of people have been forced from their homes or from refugee camps as M23 fighters continued their advance. On Tuesday, parents carried children on their backs. Other people toted belongings as they walked or biked along the dirt road, looking for a safe place to stay. Many of the refugees are coming from Minova, the town that was just seized. Some have been on the run for weeks now. France 24 spoke to one man who's been displaced twice.
I come from Karuba. The M23 forced us to flee to Minova. We were just starting to settle there, but now we've had to flee again.
Local sources say the refugees are heading towards the city of Goma, which is one of the few cities in the region still under control of the Congolese army. In the towns along the escape route, AFP reports, food and supplies are already scarce, and residents are starting to worry about the influx of refugees.
We welcome everyone, but this presence is making people paranoid. Residents fear starvation. We don't farm and we live off the lake. But with the capture of Minova, access to Lake Kivu will be limited, and that makes us very worried.
M23 rebels seized control of Minova on Tuesday. This is the latest round of fighting in a conflict that's been going on for decades. More than 120 armed groups and militias operate in the region, fighting for power, land, and minerals. The M23 is one of them. It's composed of ethnic Tutsis who broke away from the Congolese army more than 10 years ago. The group had been dormant, but resurfaced in 2022 and started capturing territory. The UN says Rwanda supports M23 with troops and weapons, something Rwanda denies. So far, Goma, the provincial capital, has been left relatively unaffected, with the army protecting it at all costs. However, with the capture of Minova, it may only be a matter of time before food and other essentials are cut off. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Hundreds of years ago, artists in the Persian, Ottoman, and Mughal empires perfected miniature art, intricately detailed illustrations that depicted moments in history, sumptuous palace life, and scenes from folklore and mythology. In Istanbul today, one artist is making the genre his own. The World's Duri Biscarin reports.
In an art gallery set in a Byzantine-era tower, I page through sheets of miniature art in the old styles. Brightly colored lovers from an old Persian fairy tale. Scholars in turbans and long robes, looking at the stars through a telescope. There's Noah and his ark of animals. There's no perspective or depth of field, rarely a horizon line. Time is flat here, too. Scenes from the past and future can appear simultaneously.
Aslında bir nebze de şu, saray sanatıdır.
It's a type of palace art, gallery manager Bilal Toplu explains. Depicting human figures publicly was frowned upon in the Ottoman Empire for religious reasons. But miniaturists illustrated books intended for private collections, so the rules were a bit bendier. Over time, the art slowly faded. The printing press reduced demand for hand-illustrated books, and ambitious Ottoman rulers started to prefer European styles of art for political reasons. But the practice is still alive, perhaps in surprising ways.
It's a popular image in traditional Turkish art.
But she's also wearing her sparkly bikini from her Eras tour.
Yes, exactly.
Artist Murat Palta is 35. He walks me through a miniature-style painting he made last spring, meant to represent a moment in time for pop culture. It's a large work, and it takes time to look through and grasp each detail in the scene. Taylor Swift flies across the sky with her emissions-spewing private jet, represented by a phoenix. And Dragon Ball, a popular manga character, surfs the clouds in a tribute to the death of its Japanese creator. The style is old, but the characters are new, and there is always a lot going on.
Back then, paper was a luxury. They had to work in one scenery, all the events taking place in only one scenery. It's kind of engineering.
Miniature artists would depict folktales and places far away, but interpret these scenes in a local style, in line with the world they knew. So what Palta does is to imagine what an Ottoman miniaturist transported from the 16th century would do with the world around them today.
Usually I start working on paper, you know, creating my own characters and my ornaments.
Palta then pulls each scene together on an iPad. After all, he says, early miniaturists always used the technology of their time. Stormtroopers, dressed as Ottoman soldiers, surround Darth Vader in sumptuous black robes as he sits to smell a damask rose. This classic pose was painted for Ottoman rulers to express their intellectual refinement and appreciation of both moral and physical beauty. In Palta's depiction of Breaking Bad, Walter White makes crystal meth in an Ottoman-style caravan instead of an RV. In another, Cookie Monster and his courtiers witness the execution of Big Bird.
I always say medium is the message. You must, you know, emphasize the whole work is modern, actually.
Palta says his favorite moments are when a collector from an older generation comes in to view his work, but happens to bring their son or daughter.
The young people don't get the whole idea at first because it's a kind of an old style, you know. And then in their second look, they realize the details, like references to popular culture, memes and that type of stuff. At this point, the young ones get the what the story is about while their parents miss those points.
As a rule, Palta does not sell prints. A work that's 40 inches square sells for more than $9,000. But he maintains a devoted following on social media and within the Turkish art world.
Murat's very unique. You're able to see his work and say, oh, this must be Murat Palta.
Zeynep Keçelioğlu Mure is a Turkish art collector who previously worked in galleries. She says Palta's style is another way that Turkish art has reached out to the rest of the world. Unlike the Ottoman-era miniaturists, who embraced European styles but nearly lost their own, Palta brings everyone into his world.
Just like art opened up and adapted, Murat's art opens up. But instead of finding space in between and merging the two, he takes both of them simultaneously and just collages them.
For the world, I'm Duri Biscarin. Istanbul.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation,
committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Judy Piggott, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.